Welcome to Nectar's Conversation Journeys. We travel to or invite the movers and shakers of the mobility, energy and climate ecosystem. Listen in and enjoy the talks.
So hello everyone. This is a special episode for me because I'm literally honored to have one of the veterans of the mobility ecosystem today in our Nectar Conversations. And that's Barak Sass. I've been following your activities for a while, and they're very broad. And I really perceive you one of the, I would call it the wizards, because you're a little bit everywhere at the same time.
Thank you.
Honored to have you in the call today in the Nectar Conversations. I would just start very simply by giving you the opportunity and the stage to talk about yourself and let the audience know whom you are and what's driving you.
So thank you for that introduction. It's an honor to be here. Barak, I've been in transportation for over 10 years now. I helped set up as an employee four different companies in vehicle import, public transportation, mobility technology companies in a career that started from finance, went on to operations, and then less positions in commercial and strategic roles. And 2 years ago, I founded Mobility Business, which is my consultancy. I focus on strategic growth, so that's go-to-market, business plan, market, competitive analysis, buy-side M&A, the planning side, but also the hands-on. So I'm working with a chauffeur ride-hailing company to launch international expansion, mobility as a service, wireless charging, rail ticketing, so very broad, as you said, in the mobility landscape. And I also have Moving People, which is my newsletter, which I started, I think, almost 5 years ago, and it started as a hobby. The first edition was sent in a Word document to my fellow co-workers at Zillow. And they said, this is nice, you should put it on LinkedIn. I'm like, fine, I'll put it on LinkedIn. And this is how it all started.
Yes. And it all snowballed from there. It's interesting how a lot of things that get kind of leading start small, but they usually start because of a passion of someone, right? You just have to do it because it's, I don't know, you ought to do it. It's really fun. Barak, with your super broad overview, what is the most, let me put it like that. What is for you the most intriguing development that you see on a macro level when it comes to mobility?
So mobility is experiencing a tough time. One, because of the general macroeconomic conditions, which have been around for 2 or 3 years. And two, because in many cases, not all, but in many cases, there were a bit of over promises in our industry and under delivery. And I think that's mostly fixed right now because of consolidations. The most recent one is Lyft and Freenow, and also the ability to reach profitability, which we see with VIA and their IPO, and we see with Void that I heard that want to IPO. So that's mostly fixed. But if you look at the funding landscape, then other than AI, everything is autonomous. And I think that if you look at mobility today, you pretty much, whether it's delivery robots, trucks, cars, buses, it's all about autonomy and the opportunities in both autonomy and teledriving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that reflects very well with let's say my perception. We recently sent out an investor newsletter, and it was titled "Mobility is Back." And it's funny because if you take a look at the Gartner hype cycle, autonomous was already there. It was already here, right? Like, you remember it.
Yeah.
It was 2014, 15, 16, GM with Cruise and on all those activities there, which was very, very much on the hardware side and Mobileye being leading, et cetera, et cetera. So this was already a big topic at that point in time, a lot of attention and capital going in there. Then it got a bit of quiet. And I think now we're in the phase of actually where we see those first real world deployments, which I find personally very, very fascinating, because it is it is stage two of the development, in my point of view, where stage one is, okay, you get to get the vehicle to be able to drive safely from A to B. But then it's about the running fleets, right? And the operational challenges that go hand in hand with running hundreds or thousands of vehicles. And that's stage two for me in this whole storyline. But I was on a board, advisory board meeting recently, and we had one slide where we were the thesis was, and this was a very strong debate, and I would like to hear your perspective on it, Parag, that ultimately what we call car sharing now and what we car hailing will over time be more or less fully consumed by autonomous, right? Or to a vast majority, maybe not fully, because of the wide band use cases where still make sense. But what's your take on that? That's question number one. And question number two, what's the time angle that you see for that to happen?
So I agree with you. The more vehicles become autonomous, and we'll touch on the time question in a second, but the more vehicles become autonomous, the more they become generic assets in a way. And we can see it both by the fact that when we talk about autonomous, we talk about Waymo and Uber and Lyft and Wave and Mobileye, but we never talk about Hyundai or Jaguar. Those are lost in the conversation. So that's the generic part of it. And I think OEMs will need to differentiate themselves, and there is opportunity, in-cabin opportunity. But essentially, if it is an asset, then it can be rented for days and weeks and months, and it doesn't really matter. And then one software, in a sense, could just create the entire demand funnel. So you could theoretically, and I think Uber are aiming for it today with partnerships with Turo, etc. You could say, I want a car from here to there, or I want a car 4 weeks, or I want a car for X amount of time. And we are going towards a future where you have these assets. The fleet management is going to be terribly important, both in how you balance them out and how you maintain them and how you make sure you've got the right vehicle for the right foreseeable demand. So there's going to be a lot of challenges over there. But I think, yes, there is going to be a consolidation in a way. In that timeline, Trump did an interesting thing. He sped up innovation globally. So he definitely sped it up in the US. But I think also Europe got a wake-up call, in a sense. And you see the UK speeding up autonomous. Mm-hmm. We are ready to roll, or are getting ready to roll, autonomous vehicles in mid-2026, and Germany just approved a teledriving bill. So we will see increased innovation. I think it will be sooner in the US than it will be in Europe, and it will be sooner in the East than it will be in Europe as well, in the Gulf states. I think if we had this conversation, 2030, then every tier one city would have some kind of either commercial or advanced pilots going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This resonates very well with me. It was interesting what you said. Could have been my line of my line of strategy when it's about the role of Europe in all of this, because I think I really said. Please don't quote me, but I really said Europe will be last in this game. And we are at the brink of being, the passive consumers of what others build for us and design for us. But it's happening, as we can see right now. I mean, those first large-scale deployments, real deployments are happening in the U.S., Asia's next, not Asia in general, but specific markets in Asia, right? And then, yes, most likely also because of the very rigid regulatory framework in Europe, it will trickle into Europe when all those players see that it finally makes sense to do that. The challenge that I see is like being a European company. We perceive ourselves to be a European company as such, right? We have business in Americas as well, but the DNA of it to be able to still contribute to that growing ecosystem, right? Because the mindset, how to put it, what I see also is the mindset is in Europe is very defensive and reactive, and it's not necessarily helpful. But just to reflect on what you said.
No, I agree with you. I mean, it's so yes, Europe is slower, and you see it also in the funding. So it's much easier for companies to go to the US and get funded. And then you know that obviously is a big help when you're starting to set up a company. We will probably, we as in Europe, we will probably be behind in terms of adoption. So we're obviously behind China, Japan, South Korea when we talk about East Gulf states, which are, you know, all of Dubai is all over new technologies and the US.
Yeah.
But the question, I think the real question, not the real question, but the other question is, okay, so maybe our regulators will take a bit more time, but let's make sure that our companies are ready so that Vi and Wave and yourself and others, they have the capital needed and they have the expertise needed to be able to scale. Because even if it will come to Europe in a 2 or 3 year delay, we will have the local technologies here. And I think it's super, super important. And I think that this actually is a call for investors and governments to encourage investments by creating tax benefits or whatever not, but to be able to encourage investment in European companies for them to be successful globally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to also, if I may add to what you just said, and to also enable companies being active there to have a, let's say, a sandbox, also from a regulatory point of view, right? To trial things and to try things out and to develop things and be not suffocated by that rigid regulatory framework, which yes, it makes sense to have in place, but not if you're in development phase. So yeah. I agree with that. We're actually now with what we're doing as a company, we're bringing efficiency to fleets, right? We optimize fleet in terms of utilization, in terms of cost, in terms of unit economics, in various ways. This is rebalancing, this is charging, this is depot optimization, et cetera, et cetera. And what we see there is that Europe actually has some advantage when it comes to, let's say, large-scale EV fleets and those being managed, yeah, because Europe was first. I guess a different motivation was not necessarily a financial economic one. But there is a certain advantage in experience that yes, we can take and transport into other markets that are more advanced when it comes to, for example, autonomous vehicles, right? So those two things can definitely merge, and I think the US got way more attention now for us as well, which is interesting, given the general macroeconomic like landscape, right? But that's for sure true. I think one thing that you said, and I want to pick up on that, if you're okay, is more vehicle. You called it an asset, right? And that asset needs to be managed by somehow. So I take a car for a ride. I take a car for a weekend, for a month, for a year, and I want to be flexible. Like my patterns, I don't know. I just got another kid. I need a bigger car. But I need that car maybe just for 3 years, right? And not for longer. So, or whatever. Or I want to go on to a ski trip into the Alps. So I need a big one because I need all the pack, all the stuff in there. So very, very situative in terms of behavior and demand coming from that behavior. How much does that call for usership-driven business models and offerings towards ownership-driven ones? And I know this is highly debated, and specifically, how to put it, there are different camps on this question. There is ownership is still culturally strongly embedded, I think, in the mindset of people and in DNA. At the same time, when I see my kids growing up, that mindset is no longer there. It's with this, with the next generation, it's going to be very much different. So what's your take, Barak?
So I'll start with an anecdote. I was at an autonomous event a couple of months ago here in London. And I told my little girl, which is 7 years old, I told her I am going to this autonomous event. And the car's without driver, and she looks at me and like, she doesn't understand why is it special. And I'm like, okay, fine. I'll start just a second with illustrating the, I think, the advantages and car sharing, for example, and then I'll go over to ownership. But I mean, if you think about car sharing and what car sharing and, you know, sharing rental, they'll be pretty much the same thing in the future. But if you look at car sharing and just teledriving or autonomous and what that can happen, the market is going to completely change in that respect, because the customer experience is totally different. You no longer have to look where the nearest car is to you, walk over to that car. No. It will be delivered to your door. So that's an amazing customer experience. Whether it's teledriven or autonomous, that happens in Las Vegas. And you know, that's amazing. And also, you will be able to pre-request, I need a baby seat, and then somebody will fit a baby seat in the logistics center. It is something, and you know, baby seat is a challenge for a lot of people. And it's something that isn't available today and will be available in the future. So the easiness and the comfort level with autonomous or with self-driven cars is amazing in respect of what it will do for demand. But it also has a lot of operational benefits, because you no longer need to look for parking. You can move away the cars from places with high vandalism. So there are a lot of opportunities that will translate into lower cost, that will translate into more demand. So you will see more and more demand. Will people decide to give up their car altogether? I am on the camp that says probably not. We'll still see car ownership. We'll probably see less car ownership and probably see less car ownership in cities. Just because of what I illustrated right now about how better or how more efficient the future is going to look like. But I do think that OEMs will try to push their vehicles, so we'll see them with new marketing tactics. Cars will still remain a status symbol. People would still like their own thing with their magazines and water bottles and whatever not. So I think we will see some sort of car ownership. That car ownership will look a bit different, because you will be able to rent out your car when you're not using it. So the entire how does ownership look like is going to be different. People will buy a car, probably not just fleets, but ownership would be totally different from what it is today.
Yes.
I wonder what your thoughts about. What do you think about it?
That resonates extremely well with me, Barak. So number one, I think the differentiation between cities and rural areas. Let's not forget, in a lot of continents, they're not just cities, right? There are a lot of rural areas, and those need to be served as well. And those will be served last when it comes to even the autonomous technology, because it's complex to do that. Number one, and expensive. Number two, the cost of ownership is gonna skyrocket if you live in a city center.
Yep.
In almost all metropoles of this world, this is just gonna be a luxury to own a car, parking in front of your house waiting for you all the time, right? So what is now maybe perceived as a standard is gonna be very, very costly at some point. And cities also don't want cars. Like they don't want that number of cars there, right? We have the city tolls coming in, like they really try to move those out.
Yeah.
Here in Vienna, where we based, clearly in 20 years in the inner circle of the city, there's no given exceptions, but there's no real ownership happening. So I think this will drive towards usership models clearly. At the same time, I also do agree there are a lot of use cases and situative patterns of consumers where an ownership heavy kind of setup makes more sense. Yeah, totally. I totally agree. So I don't think it's exclusive. What I do see happening is a large shift of vehicles that will be, let's say, managed by someone else and not necessarily the person that owns the asset, right? And you were talking about already, it's like the economies of scale that a highly efficient operational framework can provide, managing not one car, but managing 1,000 cars is a completely different game. And I think this is also driving, let's say, our strategic development as a company, to think about all those dimensions that where we are able to leverage the economies of scale for all those fleets out there who run and manage those high number of vehicles. Because eventually, and I think this is what I heard, we agree on this one, the number of vehicles managed not by the family father taking care of the car, but by someone else, maintenance, tire change, you name it, right? Cleaning, et cetera, someone else took care of that. I'm happy to pay for it in whatever form. I think we're in agreement on this one, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, there are, you know, fleets have, you mentioned it, fleets have solutions where cleaning and tire change, et cetera, are coming to them. It doesn't exist for private ownership, but it can if the app is synchronized anyway to the fleet. So yes, that will happen. I think the real disruption, by the way, is with traditional car rental companies, so Hertz, Enterprise, Six. They will see a tremendous change. They might benefit from it because today they have a lot of real estate, which probably won't be needed, and they do have the expertise in managing large fleets. They either come the big winners or the big losers, and it really depends. There's a lot of companies there. But this is a huge, huge opportunity for them in terms of changing the entire business model.
Yes, yes. I couldn't agree more, Barak, on what you said there. And I see the huge differentiator in being a winner or a loser, if you may take your picture, is the level of digitalization that companies are willing to embrace already at that point in time, right? There are still so many companies out there where the assets are dumb assets in terms of they're not connected at all, right? How can you efficiently manage something if it's not a digital asset, right? It's really, really hard. I mean, at scale. Yeah. Because this means the entire process around it needs to be human-driven. And it cannot be automated or driven by algorithms. And that level of efficiency that will be required means that a lot of those decision processes that are currently taken by like local fleet managers, I know my city and I want to put 50 cars here and let's take them away there and so on and so on. These needs to be automated and provided by technology at the end of the day to do that at scale. And that's going to be the differentiator. And I think the differentiator, and again, the driver for a company being on the loser's side or on the winner's side.
I couldn't agree more. 100%. Those companies need to be, to turn themselves into a tech company. So the fleet management has to be the best possible. The demand forecast needs to be the best possible. Everything needs to be the best based on data. Otherwise, they won't find themselves winners.
Yeah, exactly. And then what I find shocking sometimes, and I hope no one takes that personal, but I find shocking, like when I sometimes talk to OEMs, and when I talk about plans for connectivity, so out-of-the-box connectivity of the vehicles, and they hear like 20, 30 something, it's like, oh my God, you're losing out on opportunity here. Because you could be the first who could have all those add-on services on top of the vehicle, right? Enabled by the connectivity, which is a needed enabler in a lot of cases. I think I still have to be patient, I guess. What's your take?
I think OEMs haven't found out how to monetize connectivity yet. I think that the market should push for it more, because the market will benefit from connectivity quite a lot. If you think of the classic OEM model, and they are, you know, it's troubling time for OEMs right now, so they're back to the basics. If I make a car, I sell a car, I sell parts. It's pretty much it. And some importer or distributor, he takes it from there. I haven't seen almost anywhere, maybe except China, where a direct-to-consumer model is working. So let's leave that aside. In that respect, I can sort of understand why they haven't been able to monetize on connectivity. But the market can benefit so much. So fleet management companies can benefit so much from it. And then they can use it to generate more profits. And if I'm an OEM, I would get into serious discussions with the different distributors that I have in the ecosystem and say, okay, what do you actually need? And what will make you buy my car and not somebody else's car?
Yeah, that's a good one. That's an interesting one. Going back to the autonomous field, because I see currently something happening that when I first realized it, it really puzzled me. I was like, why? But maybe you have given it more thought. So what I see now happening in the US with the EV fleets being rolled out, let's take Waymo as an example. Waymo is partnering up with companies actually operating the fleet, right? There's Move on the one hand side, and there's Uber in some respects operating in other markets. And I hear there's maybe a third player in different markets. So I was like, okay, why do they outsource that? And why do they kind of risk to have different level of quality in operations, because they run with different companies and stuff like that. I do understand from other, let's say, other industries that it sometimes makes sense to decouple the operations side from the brand. Let's put it, and maybe the technology generation part. For example, in the aerospace, if you take an airport, right, it's not the airlines taking care of the ground operations, like meals, cleaning, da da da. There are specialized companies that use the economies of scale, because they do it for 20 airlines on, I don't know, Schiphol Airport in the Netherlands. But do you have maybe more insights on why this is happening strategically?
So if you look at, yes, this is something that I talk about extensively. So you look at the value chain, pretty much there's four stages. There's the OEM, then there's the maintenance, the operational management of the car or truck or whatever, of the vehicle. Then you have the tech, which is today it's built on cars after they leave the factory, but in the future it will come together. And then you have the consumer side, so Uber and whatever not. And I think that, let's take Waymo and Lyft as two examples. So Waymo, they decided that they want to be a tech company. That on that value chain that I described, they want to be a tech company. And they don't really care who does the operations, that they don't want to be involved in it, and they will leave it to companies such as Enterprise or Move, etc. And then on the demand side, they're working with Uber, but they're also having their own operation. So they're still sort of not sure what's the best way, but they do know that they don't really want to deal with operations. But when you look at Lyft, for example, Lyft has a subsidiary called FlexDrive, That company manages 15,000 vehicles.
Yeah.
They pride themselves on that. I mean, they pride themselves. It's obviously, normal vehicles. They pride themselves of being able to manage those cars efficiently. One, gaining revenue, they lease them out to gig drivers. So that's one revenue. Mm-hmm. But it also allows you to be able to assure supply. So if I'm looking at a company such as Lyft, I definitely see them more involved in the fleet management side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a real judgment call. Who am I? Am I just the demand generation? Am I just the app that you book from and the customer care, et cetera, but the demand side of it? Or do I go to the supply side? And I think that that's going to be interesting to see who takes what position in that value chain.
Yes. And I think at the moment, it's more companies are searching for the right combination of building blocks, also which or service blocks they are willing to cover, right? Mm-hmm. And experimenting at the moment with those pilot deployments in the various cities and learning from that. What I found interesting, because I've been in conversations with some of those companies, specifically dealing with the operations side, a lot of the challenges that you're currently trying to solve in the deployments in, I don't know, West Coast, US, are very similar to the problems that have been solved by, for example, car sharing companies in Europe a couple of years ago, because they were confronted with, I need to run 800 EVs efficiently in a city, right? So I need to get them charged, and so on. So it's really interesting that some of those challenges are, like, it's a little bit history repeating when it comes to that notion. Yeah.
I think that, by the way, on that, I mean, if I'm building an autonomous company, obviously what I'm focusing on is autonomous technology. And then the fleet management side, it's not the core of what I'm developing. Mm-hmm. And let's say it's a bit maybe more boring than developing autonomous technology. And so that gets kind of left behind. Now, you've seen a lot of companies, they develop for customers, but they don't always develop for themselves. I think that's what happened. I think there's a huge opportunity for those companies that you just mentioned to ramp up on the fleet management capability, learning from software houses, companies such as yourself, and the experience that large car sharing companies have, such as Zipcar in the US, but Miles in Germany and whatever not companies in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Is this game a game of giants? Is this going to be a game of giants at the end of the day?
A game of giants?
Of giants, yeah. Is it at the end of the day like size that will matter? Maybe not most, but a lot.
Yeah. I'm going back to your analysis on city versus rural. Yes, it will be a game of giants, but the same way that you don't have Uber in small places, there will be opportunity for SMEs to manage autonomous fleets in rural areas. Mm-hmm. So there will be a mix, but yes, it will be a game of chance. The same way it is today with Enterprise and Six and Health, where they control the market in a way, still be a game of giants. Even maybe more so with economies of scale.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what I'm aiming at. Like having access to a certain, being able to utilize economies of scale, requiring a certain size, also from a finance point of view, right? For example, Move, I think, recently announced that they're raising $2 billion, not equity necessarily, yeah, but for financing the vehicles for the fleets. So these is significant numbers we're talking, right?
And you know, usually when we speak about autonomous, we focus on cars.
but the logistic industry, the trucking industry, they're a bit behind. They have different challenges, and efficiency is at the heart of what they do anyway.
Yeah.
So they're a segment that's going to need to even up their game on that. Buses are also behind, quite behind. But then you open up a new world of how you manage public transportation on a synchronized level, which is something you don't have today. So to look at the entire landscape, and it's easy, cars are much more sexy and they're much more interesting to talk about. But across the board, on any kind of vehicles, there's huge opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I fully agree with when it comes to trucks and commercial vehicles, because there, every minute is worth typically quite a substantial amount of money. And this is where efficiency can really, really kick in, right? Which, as a private user, you don't maybe care that much. But in scale of trucks, and also, how to put it, when it comes to trucks specifically, the typical use cases, you see the complexity of driving a highway for 800 miles is maybe a bit different than my parents driving around rural Austria, right?
Yeah.
So I couldn't agree more. Whereas the focus, of course, of media and stuff is very much on the consumer side on that. But are you okay to play a little game with me? Because I this is a question. So I have two questions I always ask my partners in the conversations. And the first one is a game that, imagine I put the two of us into a time capsule, and I put us, I zoom us into the year 2035, so 10 years from now. And from that position of 2035, we take a look back to the two of us in the now, right? What advice would you give the two of us from the position of 2035?
Well, it's a problem, because I think you're doing the right thing. I think you're focusing on the right thing. It would be about how you enable more synergies, both on the demand side and the fleet management side, and how you use AI tools to make sense of the enormous data sets that you are going to have. And I think that probably that would go, you know, again to the giants, mm-hmm. but there's a huge, huge, huge opportunity there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I hear, in a sense, continue what you're doing and just put all you can behind it, right?
Yeah. No, I think you know your solution, and you know, I'm not here to praise your solution, but I think it makes sense. Making sure that fleets are synchronized and as efficient as possible, both on the demand side and on the supply side, is something that would be needed more and more as we move into autonomous.
Yeah, exactly. There it's good. At the moment, it's how to put it. At the moment, it's an add-on, right? But in when you talk autonomous, it's inherent. It is part of the organism that needs to be. You can't do it without.
The question is, by the way, that's a question you asked before, is time.
Mm.
I think that in 2035, especially in the US, and again, Gulf states and other parts, we are going to see tier one cities full of autonomous cars. The rest, less so, but you know, 2045, that will be a different story.
Yes, yes, exactly. And then we'll also know a lot more about how, because trickling down into on a global scale, this is going to take an enormous amount of time.
Yeah.
But if you take a look at the advent of the car as a vehicle across on a global scale, there was decades and decades and decades and decades, right? But it just took time. That's what it is. All right, perfect. So this was the first one. The second one is a tricky one. I hope you're okay with me asking that. So, what question would you give me, which I should post to my next interview partner? not knowing who he is, but just maybe something that you'd like to confront someone with.
It's something that I also ask. So I have a series of interviews on my newsletter where I interview startups. It's not a podcast; it's a written text. But going back to your question, but one of my questions is, how do you see the difference between Europe and the US? And when you speak to startups, it is always a question, because if you're a startup and you need to decide where you want to go, again, Europe is a very big world. There's no one Europe. No, we know that there's a lot of different countries and cultures. But that would be the how do you see Europe against the US, and how does Europe make sure that it creates a market, single market in a way? London, I might not be in the position to say that, but how do you create a single market in terms of regulation and ease of doing business, also on a cultural level, to allow Europe to become a much better place to make business in?
Okay. Very happy to take that into the next conversation to reflect my very personal view. It will require change at a level that is fundamental, because it's cultural change that's also a little bit required, and it will take a lot of time. Yes. And I fear, because a lot of cultural change is driven by, unfortunately, pain or painful experiences, or by really fear of being left out and stuff like that. So I think some dramatic things, but might have to happen before things get moving, and there is more there. People understand that the advantage of being united, not always, but yeah, for the purpose, is the better way to go. I guess that's a wish. When it comes to Europe versus America, yes, of course, it's totally different when it comes to culture and stuff. Like, I mean, our very first customer was US-based, by the way. The very, very first customer was US-based. Why? Because they are more willing to take risk.
Yes, they're more tech-savvy. Yes. Yes.
They're more tech-savvy. Yeah. And they there is no immediate resistance to tech, right? Yeah. Tech is seen as an opportunity, which needs to be validated. It can be validated positively or negatively, but without validation, I don't know nothing, right? So let's validate and then decide. And that gave us the chance, the opportunity to deploy this very first thought that we had in terms of value generation. And it was validated in a positive way. And then it was a strong signal for us to develop further and invest, right? And this proved to be the business case for us as a company. In Europe, way more difficult, because the people that we were talking to, they had their fixed opinion already about how things work. Yeah. And less open about being surprised about, actually didn't consider that, but still, right? It's a little bit. So that's a mechanism that I found very interesting. And it was also, funnily enough, once we had that customer in US, right, it was way easier to get a customer in Europe, because, wow, you're doing this in the US, right?
Of course, of course. Yeah.
That's how it is. At the essence, what's your take on this one?
It is a lot of cultural. It is a lot of cultural. I mean, I worked in the bus industry for a while, and this was at Zillow, and we did commute. So digital commute, how do you make commute much more efficient using a digital tool, rider app, driver app, and we sold in the UK. It was a UK company. We sold in the UK, and I led go-to-market to the US. We got into discussions with people in the US, and they were like, yeah, this is interesting. Let's try it. Your technology, which was a completely different story. And then we went to suppliers, to the bus operators, and they were much more tech savvy and they were much more willing to listen. Doesn't mean that they'll buy eventually or that they need it or fine. They're willing to hear. And I think that that when we talk about change and governments creating change, I think that innovation and tech savviness and whatever you want to call it, I think we need to improve on that. And I think that also it will be derived from pain probably as well.
Yeah.
We see eye to eye here.
Well, that's a sad, I don't know, it's a sad recognition for myself, right, to say that. At the same time, taking a look at history, that's sometimes what just what it is. But let's find out. Yeah, I truly enjoy exchanging those ideas with you, Barak, and I feel that when it comes to that, we might even be in the same boat. So being the driving forces of that change is a very intriguing thought that I have. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's been a real pleasure and a very, I wouldn't call it like-minded, but exchange of thoughts and ideas. And I learned a lot from this conversation. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me and also really enjoyed it and also learned a lot. Thank you.
You're wonderful. Dan, best of luck. I'm curious to learn what our kids, your daughter is 7, mine is 9, right? What, like in 30 years, they will talk about what we did at that point in time. But that's another discussion. Thank you, Barak.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Lectures Conversation Journeys. Subscribe and tune in again next time.